Welcome to the podcast of the Sunday Celebration from the Center of Spiritual Living in Huntsville, Alabama. We hope you feel the grace, the beauty, and the love of our community as you hear the message of the week. Have a beautiful week.
Namaste is a Sanskrit word which means the God in me sees the God in you. And in this place, we are one. So from that place of oneness, we breathe. Kelly and Bob just played a Jack Fowler song called I See God in Everything. Because everything is God. This requires that we let go of the old idea of God as a man in the sky like a Santa Claus and get a greater awareness of a presence that is everywhere, everywhere and nowhere at the same time. Abraham Maslow wrote a little book called Religion and the Peak Experience. And he said the trouble with most religions is they haven't had a peak experience. And so how can you talk about something that you haven't experienced? And when you see God in everything, you're having a peak experience. There is a wonderful saying that says there is no spot where God is not. So when we see this divine presence revealing itself in a flower that blooms, in a bee that's drinking the nectar, in the ancient tree that's rooted in Mother Earth, reaching toward the heavens, we see an expression of divine love, and it's all an expression of divine love. So something begins to shift within our perception. And we hear Dr. Ernest Holmes, who said it is the perception of wholeness, the perception of oneness, that is all healing. So when we can perceive the innate wholeness within ourselves, well, then we begin to see it mirrored in the world. So it's always an inside job. It starts with us, and then it ripples out into the world, and we see God in everything. So I invite you to take a deep integrating breath. One more breath in. And let's give a sigh for the divine. We arrive in this present moment. And we open our eyes. You know, this month I'm speaking about, because it is July, 4th of July we had this week, I'm speaking about freedom, my favorite subject. And the theme for this month is Shift into Freedom, which was a book and a class that I taught here by Locke Kelly. And he said, when you shift into freedom, what you're doing is you're shifting out of the identification with the local self, the me person, who has opinions and beliefs, conclusions, goals, attachments, neuroses. You know that part. You probably all are familiar with that self. And the shift is away from that into this consciousness that sees things through the eyes of the One. So when we know ourselves as this something that's greater, dare I say, could we know ourselves and see through the eyes of oneness instead of through the eyes of the local self? And that's the challenge, is that we shift out of the me into the we and ultimately into the all. It's all the one life. There is but one life. That life is God's life. That life is perfect. And that life is my life now. So could we make that simple affirmation that it's all the one life? It's the life of the One who's come to reveal itself through all creation. And you have to be so humble to open to this new way of looking at life. Then everything becomes a tapestry of the divine, pointing to something that was waiting to be acknowledged and to be seen. There is a wonderful line in the Quran that says, "Am I not your Lord?" which is what Allah says, Allah meaning the emptiness. And you know, it's interesting when you study Sufism, there's a little practice called the zikr, which is polishing the mirror of the heart. "Hey, Thomas, good to see you. I see some kids here. Well, come on down." And the word Allah means the emptiness. So the name of God in Sufi tradition is Allah. And they do a little practice. They say, "La ilaha illallah." There is nothing but Allah. There is nothing but the emptiness. Wow. And the more you say that, well, then if it's all Allah, if it's all the one, well, then that means y'all are part of the one as well. So could we shift our way of thinking, instead of seeing ourselves as separate and other, to see ourselves as interconnected to this one life? Last week I spoke about living in the questions, and the mind is 10 times more active when we're in the question. And there's a beautiful Hasidic saying from the Jewish tradition. This rabbi says, "Why ruin a beautiful question with an answer?" He says, "Stay in the question." So the question might be this Sunday morning, how can I have a deeper experience with my own internal freedom? How can I know God at a deeper level as an experience, not as a concept from the mind? Can I feel my way into the namaste consciousness where I see God in everyone? And so in Shift into Freedom, Locke Kelly says, first thing you do is you wake up from the local self and your conditioning and your programming. And then you wake into life on life's terms. When Thomas was away up there in Tennessee and he would call me, he was experiencing this inner something that was greater than the circumstances that he was experiencing at the time. So could we wake into whatever that personal experience is? My prayer partner in Canada, he shared with me this Sunday morning that he was estranged from his family because they'd become Mormon. And in the Mormon tradition, his lifestyle wasn't acceptable to them. And so they didn't want him to come to family reunions. They didn't want the children to see because he was a gay man. And in the Mormon tradition, this was verboten. So he went to his sister-in-law and he opened his heart. And he said, "When you reject me from the family gatherings, I feel unsafe, I feel unloved, and I feel alienated by my own family." When she saw his vulnerable side, all of a sudden she shifted from being the sister-in-law who wanted nothing to do with him to now he's her favorite brother-in-law because he was vulnerable and authentic and real. So it's possible when we wake into our felt knowingness and we share it with another, maybe we're building a bridge of understanding. So it's required that we have dialogue with our families where we're estranged instead of buying into this idea that we always have to stay at arm's length. And I say this because I'm going up tomorrow morning to fly up to Oregon to spread my twin sister's ashes, and I'm going to be meeting this family of mine, all these nieces and nephews that I've never really gotten to know, and their extended families, and we're all going to be on some remote beach with my twin in her outrageously free-spirited way. So I know that she's going to be there with me. So the question is, how can I enter into this experience up there and let it be the most loving experience for everyone, myself included? I'm going to include myself in a loving thing. Mary Oliver is a poet, and she writes this beautiful little book called The House of Light. And wherever she goes, she's experiencing this web of connectedness to all life. And at the end of the book, she writes a little poem about questions. And I thought of you, Gigi. It's called The Summer's Day. And here's what she asks. Who made the world? Remember, don't destroy a beautiful question with a silly answer. Who made the world? Second question. And who made the swan and the black bear? And who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, she says, she's holding out her hand, the one who has flung herself out of the grass and the one who is eating the sugar that's sitting on my hand. Who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down? And who is going around with her enormous and complicated eyes looking at me? Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and she floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is, she writes. I do know how to pay attention and how to fall down. Fall down into the grass. I do know how to kneel down into the grass and how to be idle and blessed and how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day long. So she says, tell me, what else should I have done other than to roam in nature and to see my oneness with everything? Doesn't everything die at last? She asks, and too soon. And then she finishes with this incredible question. So tell me, what is it, Hal, you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? So tell me, what do you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? And then could we live in that question and let it unveil itself? You've been given this sacred life. Whatever it might look like to you, it may not be the perfect life that you had planned for yourself, but you've been given it. So what do you plan to do with it? Are you going to make it sacred? Are you going to, my Zen calendar this morning said, when you can wake up every morning and see the dawn and know that you are facing eternity, well, then you've arrived in the mystery. Every morning to wake up and to be grateful, to have that breath, that in-breath, I'm still here on planet Earth, to open your eyes and to see the beauty that's all around you, knowing that you're seeing the beauty because the beauty awoke within you. And then you realize that all you ever see is yourself. You don't see what is, you see who you are. So if you see God in everything, well, guess what's awakening within you? The God is awakening within you. Last Sunday, they picked a Lisa and Etika song about could we become a reflection of the Infinite One? To know that once you choose to be a reflection of the Infinite One, well, then the Infinite One has the capacity to unveil itself yet again through you and through all creation. And boy, and then you hear the eighth psalm. What is man that thou art mindful of him? Thou hast made him a little lower than the angels and hath crowned him with honor and glory. So right there in the eighth psalm, what is man that thou art mindful of him? We are an expression of God's love, a little lower than the angels, here to glorify and to honor the one. So is your life, this one wild, passionate life that you've been given, are you celebrating it, Mr. David, on your birthday? As a sacred life that you've been given, not to waste, not to throw away, not to think that you're unlovable or unworthy. And when you find that love within you, Mr. David, well, then you're going to see it in others. And when you find the value in you, you're going to see the value in others and call it forth. So first we wake up from the illusion of who we are, somebody separate. Then we wake in to this true nature that's always already there waiting to unveil itself. Then the third thing, and shift into freedom, then you wake out into the world. And you know that the world is a reflection of your own perception. And when you see yourself as whole, well, then you're going to see the world as whole because we're not separate. And then there's this emerging of a new level of consciousness. We'll call it the consciousness of oneness. One of my great teachers, I've had so many and I've been so blessed, was a man named Llewellyn Von Lee. And he came out of the Sufi lineage. And he wrote this lovely book called For the Love of the Real, The Story of Life's Mystical Secrets. And he talks about the soul of the world is waking up. He calls it the anima mundi, the soul of the world. But it first has to awaken within ourselves. And what happens, then there is a shift out of the local perception into a perception from oneness. You begin to see things through the eyes of the one. No longer my preferences, but there's something greater that's looking through us. And here's how he so beautifully expresses it. When he gets a taste of his consciousness. The mystic comes to accept that the one is known through the many. Remember, it goes from me to we to all. It's all the one. So the one is known through the many. And yet, if we are inwardly immersed in the silence, it is easier not to get scattered, easier for our consciousness to rest in the primal oneness of life. Now, silence is the language of God. Eckhart Tolle said, everything else is a poor translation. So if we can find that silent place, the place beyond thought, there is an intelligence in that silence. That's where the knower abides. So could we be committed enough to be still? And then you hear that line from the Bible, be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am. Be still and know that I am God. Be still and know. So in order to know, it comes from the stillness, because there's not all that noise in your head, Miss Susan, anymore. Isn't it nice to find the stillness? And yet, we are inwardly immersed in the silence. It is easier to not get scattered, easier for our consciousness to rest in the primal oneness of life. So he goes on to say, working with oneness requires the attention that is always listening, always attentive. All we ever have is the moment. It's not about getting to some destination when you've arrived at a place of achievement. No, every moment is where we get to listen. So it requires that we learn how to listen, that we're always watchful. But unlike the void, oneness can be heard. It can be seen. It can be felt and tasted. You know, Allah means the emptiness, the void, and it's all basically the universe is one big empty nothingness. But yet there is this oneness which we see in form, and that oneness we can hear. We hear the birds sing. We see the flowers bloom. And so we get to have an intimate relationship with this one in the many. Unlike the void, oneness can be heard, seen, felt, and tasted. And in it we find a wholeness that nourishes and connects us to each other. A love that embraces all of life as sacred. A beauty that weaves the worlds together, and a way of living that expands to include all experience. It's all a divine experience. Even those uncomfortable moments, Michael, they're all sacred. Both the dark and the light. And in the light of oneness, suffering and darkness are accepted as part of the inexplicable embrace of the one. You begin to have equanimity in life. So when life gives you those growth experiences that don't feel comfortable, we can open to that uncomfortable experience and know that this is how we grow. Someone said to me, that's why there's the ow in growth. I thought that was kind of funny, didn't you, Thomas? That's why there's the ow in growth. Sometimes it hurts, but we get to grow through these experiences. He concludes this, in oneness, we can find a love that has no prejudice. A love that embraces life on life's terms and draws the various aspects of life together. It is an invisible love. It's not limited by form, but it's fully present nonetheless. A love that's not limited by form. We can be love in expression. We don't need an object for that love to have the reflection, because love doesn't need an object. So could we know ourselves as that? Mystics love the invisible. In Sufism, the seeker longs for his hidden beloved. It loves the silence, and it gives herself to a teacher who knows non-existence, who is absorbed in the nothingness. So when I went to study with Llewellyn, basically the teacher offers you their consciousness. And so could we have a resonance with that bigger something? Through our love for the invisible, the mystic infuses love with the void and brings the fullness of the void into life. It is always meant to be this way. We're bringing the emptiness into form. And then you hear, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. We are a form, but what we are expressing is this invisible something, which we can call love, which we can call open-hearted awareness, which we can call peace, a deep abiding peace that passes all understanding. We can call it a freedom that is bound, not bound by concepts or programming or conditioning or conclusions. And so when we begin to know ourselves as this vast field of oneness, we begin to see it everywhere in the world, reflected around us. So this Sunday, I'm speaking about the web of knowing, how there's this intelligence within the universe that wakes up within its creation, and it's always there, but we have to find it for ourselves. I came home from church last Sunday, and I sat down, and I was captivated by a 2020 movie, a remake of a Jack London classic called Call of the Wild. Now, there was a movie in the 30s with Clark Gable and Loretta Young, and it was all about a love affair. And the dog was the minor part of that story. In the true story, Call of the Wild, it's all about the dog, Buck. And it's from the very beginning where Buck was taken as a sled dog up in the Yukon, and he was put at the back of the sled dogs, and the sled owner would hit him with the whip and hit him with the whip because he wanted him to obey and conform because he had a 500-mile run to be the winner of this competition. So Buck was at the end of the sled being whipped by the master, and ultimately you saw through this beautiful movie how Buck evolved to being the head dog at the head of the thing. And through this incredible movie, he finally fled the abusive master. And he found himself being called by the wolves that were howling up in the Northwest. Jody, this movie just had me riveted. And the wolves are howling, and Buck is being called to go back to his original tribe. But then he had the loyalty to the old man, Harrison Ford, who had taken Buck and befriended him. And Harrison Ford was failing. So Buck, because he was loyal, he came back. And Harrison Ford was being attacked by a gold prospector. And the guy had a gun. And so Buck leaps up, grabs the gun from the guy, saves the old man. The man falls down, has a heart attack. Buck's lying there next to him as the bandit leaves. And there is Buck. And you hear this crescendoing music. And then you hear this voice saying, Buck finally found the master that would never abuse him again. He found the master within. And the master within was calling him to an ancient knowing. And that knowing was from the wolves that were sitting on the hill. And they're calling him. You talk about the call of the wild. And so Buck gets up from Harrison Ford's body. He gives him a sniff, saying, you know, you were a wonderful master while you were alive, but now I'm being called to the wild. So Buck gets up and he walks, and the head female wolf, Buck and she walk off in the distance. And then it says, and rumor has it, in the Yukon, there was a new order of wolf species, a wolf that was no longer afraid of humans because this strange dog had interbred with the wild wolves, and now they weren't afraid of the humans anymore because they had found a new way of approaching it. They'd entered into this web of knowing that I don't have to be a victim anymore. When the man came after Buck with the wooden stick and went to hit him, what do you think Buck did? He grabbed the stick and threw it away. No one is going to abuse me anymore. A simple little movie about a dog. Well, if that wasn't enough, I switched to nature, and nature had a story about the connections with the octopus. And I'm thinking, okay, we're taken into the web of knowing another way. And this was a scientist up in Washington State. His daughter wanted a dog. And instead of getting her a dog, he got her a baby octopus. And he got a great big tank, and she was upset. But because she was his daughter, she would sit next to the tank where the octopus was, and the octopus would look at her. And she'd look at the octopus. And then she put her hand in the tank, and he put his little tentacle up, and he's stroking her arm. And wouldn't you know it, the girl and the octopus have a love affair. And so what you would think was a dumb animal, his eye would follow her around the room. And when she would watch the TV, the octopus would sit on the edge of the cage or and tank and watch the TV with her. And then he'd look at the girl. And so the scientist's father, he was chronicling this intelligence within this silly little octopus that was getting now big. The octopus had this innate intelligence. It created a shelter for itself. It knew how to problem solve. It took a shell and it created a thing and it went under the shell. And so as he began to explore the octopuses in this documentary, they showed that octopus have two hearts. I didn't know that. And they have a brain not only in their head, but in their tentacles has the brain. So they think through their tentacles. And then they showed this octopus in the ocean finding an old coconut shell and using it as a home. So the octopus would get in the shell to protect itself, would take the other broken part of the shell and cover itself. Well, when it was so enamored of this shell, the next thing you know, the octopus was traveling around with her movable coconut shell home. She carried her home with her. You talk about a mobile home. She was carrying her coconut shell with her as she was creating a safe place for herself. And I'm thinking, this universe is intelligent. There is a level of knowing that is inherent within all creation. Could we defer to that knower within? the part of us that it has intelligence. And so if you can see it in the world, it's because you have it. If you can see the intelligence out there in the world, it's because this intelligence is waking up within you. So could we take communion with life and learn to see it with fresh eyes, that this is the soul of the world waking up, and if you see it, it's because you're participating in it. Aman Matwani wrote another little book called How We Can Change the World. And he says we change the world by seeing the world in its potential, and then we call it forth. We see the goodness in the world, and we call it forth. We see the opportunities for oneness and communication, and then we're calling it forth. So what if this is a participatory universe? And by the very thoughts that we think and the beliefs that we promote, we're literally caused to our own experience. So I found this wonderful book called Perennial Wisdom. And it's the wisdom of all the great spiritual teachings. And at the end of the book, they ask four simple questions. No, really, five simple questions. The first question is, where do we come from? Where do we come from? We come from the universe, which means we're connected to the universe. Where are we going? We don't really go anywhere. Because does the universe go anywhere? It's always there, which means that you don't die. There is no death. We're spiritual beings. We're having a human experience. The third question in this perennial wisdom is, so then how shall we live? How are we going to live? And then the last question is, why? Why are we here? At the end of the book, you talk about the web of wisdom and the web of knowing. In every spiritual path, they have one simple rule. Let's see if you could understand. This is Christianity, and this is the book of Matthew. In all things, do to others what you would have others do to you, for this is the law of the prophets. It's the golden rule. Then we go down to Confucianism. Confucianism says, do not do to others what you do not want others to do to yourself. Well, I think it sounds like the same thing, don't you think, Hal? Well, let's go to Buddhism. What do they say? Do nothing to others that you yourself would find hurtful. Do nothing to others that you would find hurtful. So now we dive into the Hindu tradition. In Hinduism, they say, this is the sum of our duty. Do not do to others that, if done to you, would cause you suffering. What goes around comes around. Jainism, which this is the form of Buddhism where they literally believe that God is in everything. So when a Jain would walk, they would sweep the pathway so they wouldn't step on a bug. That's how they believe that God exists in everything. In Jainism, they say this, treat all creatures in the world as you would like to be treated. Then we go down to Islam. No one of you is a believer until you desire for others that which you desire for yourself, because they recognize that it's all the one life. So how can you be a believer if you want it for me, but not from your not for your neighbor? Now we jump into Judaism. What is hateful to you, do not do that to another. That is the entire teaching, and all the rest is merely commentary. The entire teaching. What is hateful to you, do not do to another. Wow, can you imagine that on the national news? If this became the web of knowing? All the religions seem to be saying the same thing, Thomas. What's wrong? Taoism. Regard your neighbor's gain as your gain, and your neighbor's loss as your loss. Wow. We got Zoroastrianism. Boy, that was an ancient teaching. Zoroastrianism says, do not do to others whatever is injurious to yourself. I think we covered pretty much every base. Oh, we have the Baha'i, this lovely teaching in India. Baha'i says, lay not on any soul a load that you would not wish to be laid upon you, and desire not for anyone the things that you would not desire for yourself. So here we have the golden rule in a million different guises as this web of knowing that if it affects your neighbor, it affects you. So could we sense our interconnectedness, our interbeingness? Thich Nhat Hanh, one of my teachers, he's the one that coined this phrase up here that says, I have arrived, I am home. He talks about arriving in this place we could call home, Jesus called it the kingdom of heaven that's within. This is a place of wholeness. It's a place of realization that it's all the one life. And it's awake. It's loving. And it's available. It's as intimate, in the Quran they say, it's as intimate as the jugular vein. That's how close this presence is. So could we start having a relationship to that invisible presence and knowing that when you travel to Germany for 4 weeks, that this presence is going to be with you. It's going to be breathing with you. It is the breath within the breath. Yeah. And then we go through life going, Namaste. The God in me sees the God in you. We see the tree. Namaste. The God in me sees the God in you. We see the little bird hopping across. Namaste. The God in me sees the God in you. And then guess what happens? Well, then this web of knowing begins to awaken within the creation. And we are the creation, but we are also the creator, experiencing this sense of oneness. Could we allow that to begin to flower in our experience? Jody, you want to ring the bell and I'm going to do a little meditation. Mindfulness bell. It's calling us to be still. To be here now. To observe what is arising within you right now. I invite you to feel the vastness of the love that you are. The way we can do that is just imagine in your mind's eye somebody that you deeply love. Maybe it's an animal, a pet. For me, it could be this penguin that I'm holding in my arms. And whatever the object of that love is, let the object image dissolve and stay with the feeling of the love. This love intensifies as we can now bring that love to our own self, the life that we've been given. Could we love this life, knowing that it gave us the breath so that we can breathe? It gave us these legs so that we can run and walk and dance. It gave us these beautiful hearts so that we can feel connected to each other and to the world. Life has given us this beautiful mind so that it can imagine the unimaginable. Imagine no religion, I wonder if you can. Imagine no war on planet Earth. Imagine people loving one another and practicing the golden rule, doing unto others as they would have it be done unto them. Choosing to know that what happens to our neighbor happens to ourselves. And so we no longer see ourselves as separate, but we see ourselves as interconnected in this one life to all creation. So what happens to the trees and to planet Earth happens to us. What happens to the little animals? What happened to that little octopus happened to that little girl. They were connected. And so we feel our interconnectedness. And we rest in that sense of belonging. We belong to the universe. We are made out of star stuff. It says in the Bible, in the beginning, darkness was on the face of the earth. And God said, let there be light. And the light that was the first creation was Shekinah. And Shekinah is the light within. And so out of the darkness comes this light within, and we are that light. So we rest in that awareness. And we feel the alchemy of light. When we bring the light into a dark room, well, then the darkness disappears and the light illumines what is and what is possible. So could we bring the light of spirit, the light of our soul, to this world that needs the light right now, where there is a lot of darkness? And so rather than fight the darkness, we bring the light of love, the light of understanding, the light of a deepest acceptance. And in that accepting, we meet the pain, the suffering, and it is transmuted through the embrace of the One. And we are that embrace. So breathe in again and feel that connection that you have that's always there, knowing that you have arrived in the sacred moment and that you are home in the heart of the One that knows no other. And it says in Sufism, when the window of the heart is open, well, then love can flow from heart to heart. But they also say, if there's no wall between us, well, what need is there of a window? So the walls come down, the window of the heart opens, and the love begins to flow. And we smile because we're in the flow. And to this web of knowing that's within and all around, let us place our hands over our heart and say, I honor you.
I honor you.
I respect you.
I respect you.
I love you.
I love you.
You are the emerging presence of the One.
You are the emerging.
Flowering in the soul.
Discovering our oneness.
And celebrating our diversity. Trusting in this interconnection. We listen. We hear.
We smile,
and we say yes.
We say yes.
A thousand times yes. And it is done unto us as we believe. So now we believe in the One as our own self, soaring with the eagle,
swimming with the dolphin,
laughing like an octopus. All is well. So thank you, my loves. Hold me in your prayers. I'm going to go spread my sister's ashes this week up in Oregon. So I'll be back next Sunday.
For more information, please visit www.cslhuntsville.org. You are love and you are light. Namaste.